Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Alice Alliance by Charles Lamb, narrated by Daniel Thomas May. Chapter 1. General Jake Thomas sat astride his hover cycle as he scanned the valley below, his all-encasing combat suit doing its best to dispel the beginnings of another hot desert day. Stopped on a hilltop high above the surrounding countryside, he had a commanding view of the Nevada desert landscape below. As he scanned the horizon, the clarity of the dry air never ceased to amaze him. He could see for 100 miles in all directions, the occasional dust trail against the clear blue sky, betraying the movements of some remote person or persons. With horseback still the prevalent mode of transportation for a significant portion of the population, the sight before him was not unusual at all. "What do you think?" Jake asked his companion, a smaller version of himself astride his own hovercycle.
"They don't look very friendly,"
was the short reply.
"That was my thought as well,"
Jake responded with a nod and a smile. Just a few miles away from where the pair had landed were almost a dozen armed men, all on horseback and moving at a relaxed pace. Jake noted there were 2 stragglers a bit behind the main group, and he suspected they were acting as some form of a rear guard. He dialed up the magnification in his helmet and did a quick assessment of the entire group before deciding on a course of action. When he was out riding like this, it was a regular occurrence for him to run across various small groups traveling from place to place. In most cases, it was families or groups of such like-minded people just looking for a better life as they headed west toward the coast. The men in this gaggle were not to be even remotely confused with those people. By now, the group had spotted the 2 figures on the hilltop and halted their progress as they talked amongst themselves. Jake observed a pair of binoculars being passed from man to man and noted they didn't seem too concerned as they sat there talking. After watching the group for a few minutes more to see if they gave him any indications of their intentions, he made up his mind on his own.
"Stay here and watch for trouble," Jake said as he adjusted several settings on his hovercycle and then slowly rose into the air.
"Yes, sir,"
came the soft reply. Both Jake and his companion were in their standard-issue protective suits, so Jake had little concern over either one of them being injured with a conventional weapon. That was part of his survey of this party, assessing the threat level of the visible weaponry. His conclusion was, unless someone had a missile strapped to the underside of their horse, the 2 hovercycle riders were relatively safe. Moving at an easy pace himself, Jake slowly maneuvered his hovercycle into a position about 20 feet in front of the riders and sat down softly. He had done his best not to spook the riders' horses. However, a couple of the mounts shuffled nervously on their feet as the riders worked to keep them calm. Climbing off his own ride and taking great care to telegraph his moves so as not to provoke the men, he stopped a few feet from the group.
"Morning,"
Jake offered, his voice artificially replicated from inside his helmet.
"Morning,"
one of the men replied in return.
"Nice ride you got there,"
another commented, as all studied the hovercycle behind Jake.
"Thanks, it meets my needs. Where are you boys headed?"
Jake asked casually, trying not to sound confrontational.
"Not sure that's any of your business,"
the one Jake took to be the leader replied.
"Fair enough, just trying to help."
"You some kind of local authority around here?"
another man next to the leader asked Jake. Jake considered the question for a moment. Between his combat suit and the hovercycle, it was more than obvious he wasn't your typical drifter.
"Not really, but I do know those that are. I only stopped by to let you know there are some reports of a group making trouble in the area. You see anyone on your ride in?"
Jake asked, innocently.
"What kind of trouble?"
came the reply. "Oh, you know, shaking down the locals, raiding, pillaging, and just making a general nuisance of themselves. Haven't killed anyone yet that I know of, so they haven't crossed the point of no return. Well, all but one, anyway." By now, the entire group had formed a semicircle around where Jake stood. He noted the 2 stragglers had not joined up with the others, forcing a quick survey of the area on his heads-up display. Satisfied with what he saw, he returned his attention back to the riders.
"Point of no return?"
one asked before a dirty look from the leader shut him up.
Oh, you know, it's the difference between a bully and a murderer. One gets a second chance. Before another word was spoken, the one Jake pinned as the leader pulled a handgun from his belt and fired several rounds at Jake. All found their mark but failed to deliver the expected results. That wasn't to say Jake didn't feel the effects of the rounds. He was sure there would be a bruise there by tonight.
So, you would be the one that killed the Tonopah man?
Jake asked, unfazed by the action as he focused on the shooter. Tonopah was nothing more than a water stop for travelers headed east-west to and from California and Utah. This group had wandered into a small town and quickly departed after taking supplies and shooting the proprietor when he objected. The killing had been an act of unnecessary violence.
Get him!
The man shouted as he suddenly spurred his horse toward Jake, attempting to run him down. The horse's lunge surprised Jake, but he was still able to spin as the animal closed the short distance to his position. Rolling along the side of the horse as it passed, Jake grabbed the rider's leg, pulling the boot from its stirrup and yanking hard, unseating the rider in the process. It was then an alarm sounded in Jake's helmet, a proximity alert he had set before leaving his companion alone on the hilltop.
Tim, can you hear me?
He asked as he watched two men leap at him from horseback.
Yes, Dad,
was the cautious response. Tossing one man, as he flew through the air, Jake turned to find the other swinging at him with a rifle. Holding it by the barrel, the man was using it as a club.
How close were you planning on letting those two behind you get?
Not waiting for the response, Jake intercepted the butt stock with both hands, jerking the weapon free from its wielder and sending it flying at two more men still on horseback. The impact knocked them both from their saddles, while the remainder of the group backed their mounts away from the fighting to watch. Pulling his handgun from its holster, Jake fired off several rounds, hitting the ground next to the prone figures struggling to get up.
Enough!
Unless you all want to die, cut the crap. Emphasizing the point, he executed the program he had preset in the hovercycle. One of several he had worked out over the years, the craft quickly rose into the air at no more than twice his height, and low enough to knock a man off his horse if he wasn't careful. Nose down, the hovercraft quickly moved to a position just outside the farthest rider and began circling the group. Suddenly, both machine guns in the nose let loose a burst that dug into the earth and startled the horses, causing one rider to fall.
Okay!
Jake heard one man say as they all began dropping their weapons. Motioning for everyone to dismount, Jake began to check the men still lying motionless on the ground. Satisfied none were dead, he stepped away from the group.
Alice, please send in the pickup squad.
Already on their way,
came the simple reply. Limac was reviewing the duty logs of all neutral zone patrol ships from the last few kilocycles, trying to determine the source of the discrepancy in their data. Several of the sensors the Nihau had placed all along the neutral zone established with the humans megacycles ago kept alerting for trespass violations. However, when the Nihau ships arrived at the location of the violations, there were no violators to be found, just empty space. The boundary was created after the treaty had been established. It had been mined on the Nihau side with inhibitors that prevented the use of FTL drives. Once activated by the offending vessel's drive signatures, they would continue to operate until reset by the Nihau military. With the inhibitors triggered, the offender would be required to travel a good distance on repulsor power, taking several cycles to do so before they were outside the influence of the devices. Once triggered, an all-system alert would be sounded and the nearest patrol ship would be dispatched to confront the offender. While there had historically been very few incidents, and most of those identified as smugglers and not human combat vessels, each was treated with top priority. Any Nihau military vessel could reset the devices, thus removing the hold it placed on the offenders. However, that was the problem of late. With each recent alert, the responding Nihau patrol craft arrived to find no ship trapped in the field. In every instance, there were no sensor readings revealing any non-Nihau ship, just empty space. This was what had drawn them to their current position in this sector. Upon their arrival, they became ensnared in the same trap, expecting to confront a neutral zone violator. Instead, they found the same empty space as reported by other ships' captains.
Limac was just about to order the inhibitors to be reset when his ship's pilot made an announcement.
Sir, I see something,
the man announced.
Can you be more specific?
Limac replied, not surprised at the man's lack of specificity. In the megacycles since General Kalab's ascending to power, the Nihal military had undergone a significant restructuring. Field commanders were now allowed far more discretion on both their decision-making and actions, with much less concern about the repercussions of those choices back home. The changes had proven remarkably successful overall, but the increase in crew morale was offset with a drop in the severe discipline of the old order. Limac wasn't sure it was missed by many in the lower ranks and even their commanders.
There, sir. Something is masking the visible starlight,
the man said as he pointed out the bridge windows. As he spoke, he highlighted a particular part of space in the window using the optical overlay system. Shifting his attention from the pilot and onto the space outside the ship, he concentrated on the area of space the man had outlined. After staring out the bridge window for a few microcycles, he suddenly noted a portion of the starfield he had been watching blank out completely.
There!
He heard the pilot exclaim, as the man had apparently seen what Limac had witnessed.
What do you see on the sensor displays?
Limac asked his tactical officer as he continued to watch the stars slowly blink off and then on again, as something passed between them and Limac's ship.
The sensors do not indicate anything is there, sir,
the tactical officer replied.
Is it a new form of cloaking? Have the humans created a new ship?
Limac asked.
Possibly, sir, but I don't think it's human. I am getting no readings at all, not even the trace emissions of repulsor drives,
the tactical officer replied.
Perform a wide-spectrum scan of the area, including the invisible wavelengths. See if anything is reflecting off that ship,
Limac asked his science officer.
Yes, sir,
was the reply.
I have something,
the man replied hesitantly, after a brief pause.
Explain, he asked.
I am not getting any reflections for the ship ahead, but what I can detect is a void in the area around it, like a null field,
the man replied with pride.
Can you get us any closer?
Limac asked the ship's pilot.
I can try, sir, but at this distance it might take some time,
the man replied as he began working to get the ship moving.
Reset the inhibitors,
Limac commanded, removing the impediment to their jumping to close the distance. As he watched, Limac could see the disturbance in space grow, measured by the number of background stars disappearing from view as if the ship was closing on them. Suddenly, there was a field of stars where there had once only been blackness.
What just happened?
He asked aloud.
It is gone, sir,
the tactical officer reported as he continued to check his readings.
What on earth was that?
Limac asked, using the latest Nihal slang for a place no one would ever want to go. 13-year-old Tim Thomas sat astride his hovercycle, parked on a hill as he watched the scene below him unfold. Suited up in his riding gear, a derivative of the Adult Combat Battle Dress Uniform, or BDU, he could clearly make out the exchange between his father and a group of locals they had happened upon. His riding gear, helmet and all, were configured for the younger, leaner wearer, without the militaristic appearance the adult version had. He had his helmet magnification turned up so he could see the exchange involving his father and about a dozen armed men. While everything appeared calm, Tim had seen these interactions escalate quickly in the past. It was for that reason that his dad had insisted he wait here, well out of reach of their weapons, while he checked things out. The decision had frustrated Tim, as he knew he had the same protection in his suit as his father had, possibly even the strength of several of those men. As it was with his other half-brothers and sisters, Tim had inherited some of his father's unusual abilities. In his case, he was exceptionally fast and strong, but with limited telepathic abilities. He had discovered his advantages over the other kids his age early on and paid a stiff penalty for the one time he had used it on another boy. After a scuffle had broken out between himself and another boy, Tim had lost his temper and tossed the kid across the recreation room, breaking the boy's arm in the process. The event was burned into his memory, although his father had not yelled or lectured him about his actions.
"Follow me," he had instructed, as he led Tim into the workout room 3 levels down.
Once inside the gym space, he had cleared out the current occupants and then stared at him calmly before finally commanding him.
"Hit me," he said as he waved him forward. Tim was sure it was a trick, but he did as he was told. For the next 20 minutes, his dad blocked his every attempt, sparring with him aggressively without actually striking him, and giving him a bruising that lasted for days.
"The next time you get angry, I had better find you in here taking it out on this equipment," he had said before leaving him lying on his back in the center of the exercise mat, battered and exhausted. Tim could only nod in reply as he worked to catch his breath. Only later did he learn that his mother and Alice had been watching the whole episode, making sure he never got really hurt. He wasn't sure if that made him feel any better, but he never again lost his temper with the other kids.
"Tim, can you hear me?"
he heard over his headset, bringing him back to the present.
"Yes, Dad,"
he replied as he noted the tone in his dad's voice. Tim knew he was about to be schooled.
"How close were you planning on letting those two behind you get?"
he heard on his helmet audio. Not pausing to check his instruments, Tim slammed the hover cycle into hover mode and braced himself for the violent ride straight up to 500 feet AG, or above ground. Once he leveled off, he checked his displays, noting the two men with rifles standing no more than a foot away from his previous position. From his current location, he now had a grand view of his father as he pummeled the last of the strangers that had thought to jump him, while the two below him could only stare up in wonder. This wasn't the first time Tim had watched a wandering group of drifters take on his dad, but it was the first time he had been this close to danger himself. In his mind, he might have been more than a match for the two below, given the opportunity, but he should have detected their approach long before, and he knew it. He watched as his father checked each of the fallen men, asking Alice to verify they were still alive. Once finished, he requested a pickup for the entire group, including the two who had been stalking Tim. It was standard practice to dispatch a helicopter-transported combat team to collect the raiders and bandits after such an encounter and process them. Each person would be evaluated for retention or relocation based on the Alice's opinion of their value to the community. Ever since the truce with the Nihau, an event Tim couldn't even remember as it was so long ago, his dad and the other grown-ups had been working harder than ever to restore civilization on Earth. Still woefully understaffed, no one was dismissed out of hand as completely useless. It was a rare few that were relocated to places unknown. Impatient to land, Tim knew better than to come down from his hover before his father told him to do so. Should he disobey the carefully explained instructions he had received years before, he would lose his exploration privileges. In this case, it would be his mother who enforced that rule, not his dad. After what seemed like forever, a helicopter arrived and Tim watched as it stopped a short distance away. He heard a few gunshots before everything went quiet. Confused at first, he realized they were picking up the two men who had been creeping up on him. He then watched as the helicopter rose once more and quickly landed near his father. He had watched earlier as his dad had secured the unconscious men and then gathered all the weapons the men had been carrying. As the helicopter landed, several troops exited the rear ramp, jumping clear of the ramp before it had even fully opened.
"Okay, Tim, you can come on down,"
he heard his father say as he watched the troops start loading the men into the helicopter. Doing as he was told, Tim slowly lowered his hover cycle into position next to his father's, before dismounting and approaching the activity before him. Standing next to his dad, he could see into the helicopter bay, where the security troops, responsible for the policing of the areas around each Alice facility, were seating each of the prisoners. Tim had asked one time why they had a separate force for keeping the peace and one for fighting the battles that erupted from time to time as they worked to stabilize the planet. To his eye, they all seemed to be equipped and act the same. His father had explained to him that combat troops made a very poor police force, as they were trained to kill and destroy. Police, on the other hand, were trained to subdue and control. He wasn't sure he understood the difference, but his father made it sound important, so he just went with it.
"That was a good move, jumping to hover until you understood the situation," his dad commented as the two watched the helicopter being loaded.
"I didn't know they were there,"
Tim admitted slowly.
I know. I wanted to see how you would react, and you did the right thing, he heard his father say with pride.
Thanks,
Tim said without looking up at his dad.
Sometimes I just want to go for a ride without everything being a test,
he thought silently to himself.
Chapter 2 Sarah sat in her office, going over the latest reports from Alice 3. Since Jake had established the truce with the Nihal, either Alice 3 or Kola had operated along the neutral zone, acting as a remote forward operating station. Each with a large complement of fighting ships in their hangars, they were considered a significant deterrent to any Nihal-aligned world's transgressions. Not content to rely on the Nihal-deployed FTL inhibitors, the Earth had deployed a number of devices of their own making, derived from the unit recovered by Jake's attack on the Nihal raider base before the truce. Although far fewer in number than what the Nihal had deployed, they were a reminder to all that both sides were keeping watch. The information she had before her was just the latest in a string of sightings on the Nihal side of the zone. Becoming more and more frequent, they would detect a Nihal patrol ship appear, linger for a short time, and then disappear as if searching for something. While no confrontations had occurred to date, the fear was they were testing the barrier, looking for weaknesses on the human side. Curled up in one corner of the room, Kona, the German shepherd Jake had rescued so long ago, lay quietly watching her. At first, Sarah had reservations about the dog, but those were quickly replaced with loving affection. Even though Jake had been her rescuer, Kona had taken to Sarah from the first, always at her side and a constant guardian of their twin girls. As if the thought of her daughters had been given to action, one of her girls suddenly burst into her office, stopping short of her desk and staring intently at her mother as she did so.
"Words, Amber, I can't hear you thinking as your father can,"
Sarah said with some irritation.
"I'm sorry, Mom. Jade and I were wondering if we could go see Aunt Bonnie and Julie,"
she blurted out quickly. Sarah's sister Bonnie was mother to the twins' half-sister Julie, and the three girls had become very close as they all got older. As of late, the trio had been spending a considerable amount of time together, more than usual. Sarah was not fooled in the slightest about the request. Bonnie and Robert, together now for over 10 years, had recently decided to have a child of their own. The little boy, not quite a year old, had all three girls doting over him like he was their own. Robert Jr. by name, though everyone called him Bobby.
"We can take the noon transport and still be home before dinner. Aunt Bonnie said it was okay,"
she added as she waited for her mother's reply. Sarah was well aware that the regularly scheduled high-speed transport could make the trip between the Nevada and Texas locations in less than an hour. Intended for Alice official personnel use only, no cargo, they ran regularly scheduled runs between all 8 Alice locations, as well as London and Hong Kong. She knew it was safe, and the girls would be well looked after. There was other, larger craft used for commerce and heavy lifting work that also ran on regular schedules, but the kids had taken to using the smaller craft as their own personal taxis, as Jake had referred to them.
"Be home on time tonight. No staying over. We promised your father a family dinner,"
she replied with a sigh. Before she had even finished her sentence, the girl spun in place and rushed out the door.
"She said yes!"
Sarah heard in the distance before her door closed. Pausing in her work, Sarah decided to call her sister before the transport left, allowing her time to intervene if necessary.
"Hey, sis, how's it going?"
Bonnie said in surprise, her face in the display causing Sarah to smile. From the background, she could see Bonnie was hard at work in her own office as well.
"Did the girls check with you before asking me if they could come for a visit?"
Sarah asked suspiciously.
"Julie asked if it would be okay if they came by. I told her it was up to you,"
she answered.
"The story I got was you had already approved the trip,"
Sarah said with a laugh.
"It's fine, they aren't any trouble. I will admit walking into a room full of teenagers all sitting completely quiet is a bit disturbing." "Yes, I just had to remind Amber to use her words. You would think we would be used to it by now,"
Sarah replied in frustration.
"And if I wear one of the headsets Alice gave us so we could hear them, they stop doing it,"
Bonnie replied with a laugh of her own. Sarah knew she was referring to the headset Alice had originally designed for Jake to deal with the Nihal emissions.
Working not only as a transmitter and receiver, but the original unit also translated his words into Nihal before transmitting them. The same units provided the mothers of the gifted children only needed to receive and verbalize the telepathic transmissions for the wearer to hear.
"The twins tell me I am invading their privacy if I use mine,"
Sarah answered.
"Okay, well, I will keep an eye out for them,"
Bonnie responded, wrapping up the conversation.
"And send them home tonight. Don't let them talk you into staying over,"
Sarah added.
"Bye, sis,"
Bonnie finished before cutting the link.
"Bye,"
Sarah replied before her screen went blank. Turning back to her work, Sarah smiled at the thought of how much better her daughters' lives were than her own at that age. Their future prospects were so much brighter than the way she and Bonnie had grown up. Jake was leading his son back to the Nevada facility as the pair jumped ahead of the helicopter transporting the latest batch of troublemakers. He had seen the regional reports supplied by the community patrol, the reason for the morning's excursion. Residents in the area had been complaining of a small group of armed men harassing the smaller towns and settlements, robbing, stealing, and just making a general nuisance of themselves. He normally wouldn't have gotten involved, preferring to allow the locals to handle things, but the death in Tonopah had escalated things. Working hard to bring the area back from the devastation created by the Nihal attack so long ago, he couldn't allow this group to continue on to other communities. He dared not tell Kathy he was taking Tim with him on this run, unsure if he would even be able to find them, but he wanted the boy to get some more experience in the open. No different than any other mom, Kathy would be concerned for her son's safety and angry at Jake for exposing him to the perceived danger. While never in any serious risk, even with the two jumping him from behind, Jake knew the boy's abilities better than he did. Also, someday Jake might not be there to intervene. Speeding over the Nevada desert at 150 miles per hour, Jake had them at just over 100 feet above the ground. He knew Tim loved to weave in between the hills, whipping back and forth as they followed the narrow valleys and dry riverbeds. Admittedly, Jake enjoyed the ride every bit as much as his son.
"Okay, Tim, we have a dead end coming up. Let's take it up to 500 feet,
he said as he checked the display on the hovercycle dash. The map overlay indicated the dry riverbed they had been following narrowed into a channel far too small for their rides.
"Yes, Dad,"
he heard in reply as he pulled back on the controls and watched the heads-up display altitude indicator in his helmet while tracking his son's ascent. Clearing the height of the peak ahead, he was treated to a clear view of the valley beyond the rise before him, and a straight run home.
"Going down,"
Jake said aloud as he led Tim back down the other side, punching 100 feet AG into the hovercycle and transmitting the setting to the other ride. The setting prevented the hovercycles from dropping below 100 feet above ground under the vehicles. It allowed for a dramatic descent, one Jake compared to a roller coaster ride, without risking an overshoot and auguring into the hard desert floor.
"Whee!"
he heard in his helmet as Tim couldn't resist the outburst at the dramatic change in altitude. All too quickly they arrived at the Alice facility hangar doors, the pair opening well before their arrival.
"Follow me down,"
Jake replied as he slowed and lifted the AG limiter, permitting their descent into the black hole in the desert floor below them. Dropping into the darkness, Jake led Tim into the hangar and then hovered just over the floor as they slowly maneuvered their rides to the designated parking area.
"Don't tell your mom about what happened today," Jake said to the boy quietly as they removed their helmets.
"Don't tell your mom what?"
the pair heard in reply before Tim could answer. At that point, the following helicopter appeared, dropping into the hangar and flooding the area with the sounds of the whirling helicopter blades. The twin hoops atop the fuselage were remarkably quiet in Jake's opinion, but not completely silent, thus interrupting his reply.
"Jake, did you take Tim into another fight?"
Kathy asked as it quieted while watching the security team approaching the helicopter, a dead giveaway to its contents.
"Not intentionally. I didn't know they were there," he lied.
"Jake, if anything ever happened to that boy—"
she started.
"Mom, I'm fine. I'm in my suit, and those two guys never even touched me,"
Tim blurted out in reply as he tried to defend his father.
"What two guys?"
Kathy shouted as she exchanged looks between the two suited figures.
Go get changed, Jake said as he waved Tim away while trying to think of a way to distract the enraged mother of his child.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?